Here. Take this with your hair, will you?
Oh, yeah, all right.
Get out of here.
Got it. And that? Okay. We got water there for you, too. How many drink out of
it? Go. My name is Wayne Butler. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here. Grateful to be sober. I love AA. I want to thank Kathy for inviting me to share and for Dana Banana, I guess it is, for being her sufficient substitute, looking after me. I appreciate being here. I know a couple of the speakers. I know many of you. I've been reacquainted with some people I haven't seen for 20, 30 years, and we're all still sober. Isn't that a kick in the butt? I got to tell you, it's a... Because I've been in places where I've seen people that I used to know, and they're taking up white chips. And I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to be depressing. I mean, I can go from zero to dumb in about 2 seconds. And I got to get this off my mind. Remember, how many of you were here for Ricky's talk? Oh, perfect. You'll get this then. Them slackers that weren't here, they won't get it. No offense. Don't hurt me. Okay. Well, I could not go to sleep to save my soul last night because I could not get that song out of my head. When she was coming up here, people started shouting out, "Ricky, don't lose that number." Right? Did you know there's an AA version of that? Of "Ricky, don't lose that number"? It goes like this. "Ricky, we've got your number. We saw you coming, Ricky. We've been prepared for you, the fledgling newcomer that's lonely and scared. Early sobriety can be dangerously tricky, Ricky. So God positioned us to be your guide so you can't hide behind the thunder of doubts and fears that might otherwise pull you asunder. Yes, Ricky, we are able to help you through this prism of alcoholism as you wailed for help as the human powers failed to relieve you. Why could we help? Because, Ricky, we've got your number." I woke up to that in my head at 6:05 a.m. for crying out loud. So if this talk crashes, Ricky, it's your fault. And I also want to say this. I want to thank that NA speaker that came right before me. You know, you hear a lot. We hear intergroup things, don't we? Where, well, that program. I've actually had people from NA come to AA and say the reason they came to AA is because NA is not working. And I have to tell you, if that talk is any description of how NA is working, you're just doing fine. I have to tell you. I'm just one of them purists. I drank a lot. I want to become an alcoholic before I get into my story, because after you hear the early parts of my story, you might think I'm in the wrong program. You might think I need to be in a psych ward program. Because I have issues. Anybody else have issues that seem impossible to solve? And science has tried everything they got to solve it, and they can't solve it, and you just have nowhere to go. And I had no idea. I want to thank my primary influencers. There's 12 of them, and I didn't just make that number up. I've got 12 primary influencers in my sobriety, and I'm going to go through them in my talk and tell you how so important they are to me. And I hope you have heroes. Don't let those people that say it's ego to have a hero in AA. Because they don't have one, I don't understand. I don't care. It's not my business. But I do. I've got heroes in AA. And 11 of my heroes have gone on to the big meeting. But I still live with them every day in my consciousness. How they talked to me, how they treated me, how they worked with me, and how they wanted to make sure that I had the best opportunity for AA and to not get divided within AA. And I will forever be grateful. My sobriety date is the 8th of November, 1977. I've had no booze, pills, powders, potions, or lotions that affect my emotions from that day to this. However, I do have a history of dating mind and mood altering women, but you don't got to get a chip for that. So I don't do it no more, though they come up with a new program. I don't want to go there. I had no idea anything about alcoholism, and I don't think you probably did either. We say our parents were alcoholic, but do we really know what that means back in the day? I had no clue. And, you know, my father was a raging alcoholic by his word, came to AA and raised his hand. So I can say that. I can't diagnose anybody, but he diagnosed himself, and so I'm just reporting his diagnosis that came through his lips. And I watched him drink. I watched him drink that brown whiskey. I watched him beat my mom half to death. I watched him beat me half to death. And I'm not bad-mouthing my dad. I hope he rests in peace, because he got my forgiveness when he raised his hand, said, "I'm an alcoholic." Well, I had to look at Billy. It's not my fault. Where was I? That's the trouble when you don't have a canned pitch. You got a memory like mine. You got to make stuff up. So, what makes me alcoholic? You know, I wanted you to give a shout out to Clancy. God rest his soul. When I was 18 days sober, I heard him give a talk on the disease of perception, and it went over my head. But I put it away for future reference, just like he said I should do. And I didn't quite understand that disease of perception until I was sober a few 24 hours and dug into our literature. And now I've come to understand a little bit of what he meant by that. I've got this thing. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to describe for you, new people. How many of you in your first year? One, two, three, and the rest of you are old-timers, right? Okay, three. So how many, one to five? Five to ten. Well, this is a gray-haired group is what this is. So, okay. I want to say that I had no idea there was a difference, because I hear people say we're all just garden variety alcoholics. I don't like it when people put me in their all category, because I'm not a garden variety alcoholic. I'm a Bill W. type alcoholic. And I want to say that so that you know, if you're new and you're sitting in a room, if you're a Bill W. type and you've got a bunch of Dr. Bob types around you, you may feel like you don't fit in AA if you don't know the difference between the two personality types. So I want to share about that tonight for some strange reason. I've never done this at a meeting before. I don't know why I'm doing it tonight, but here we go. I was really confused about my life when I got to AA. I had so much diagnosis psychiatrically in my life that I didn't know if I was winding my butt or scratching my watch. And it helps to know what makes me alcoholic, don't you agree? Now, Bill spent four chapters in this precious book describing. He didn't define alcoholism because he knew I could break any definition he's got. So he described what it looks like to be alcoholic, using a doctor's opinion and three further chapters in the big book. But then he simplified the entire thing with one sentence. And I almost missed it because he hit it in the chapter, We Agnostics. I'm a Christian, I thought. So I wouldn't read chapter 4, I said to my sponsor. He says, why won't you read chapter 4? I said, because I believe in God, I believe in Jesus. And he says, well, why don't you read chapter 4? I said, because it's entitled We Agnostics. If I read that chapter, God's going to think I'm not serious. He looked at me and he says, you're a special kind of stupid, ain't you? I didn't know they could talk to you like that. I've been trying to learn how to kiss myself in the mirror through therapy, and here he's calling me a special kind of stupid. Now, I'm going to put this in the first, and my sponsor finally got me to read chapter 4, and I'm glad he did, because I discovered I'm a chapter 4 alcoholic. I didn't identify with a lot of the descriptions in the first part of the book. I was a lightweight drinker. Many of you probably drank much more than I did in content. But what it did for me and to me in this brief time that it did weighs out to be chronic alcoholic. But here's what Bill implies makes me alcoholic. And I'm going to put this in the first person, so when you read it, I don't want you to think I'm being a hypocrite. I'm paraphrasing. I'm adding the eye perception. It says, if when I honestly want to, do I find I cannot quit drinking entirely? And I don't like this test already. See, my sponsor took these statements and made questions out of them, so I couldn't beat them. And how many of you have taken the John Hopkins 20 questions for alcoholism? Like you take these 20 questions, make you an alcoholic or not? Well, if that test helped you, bully for you. Personally, I think it's the stupidest test I've ever seen. And here's why I say that. I'm a read-aheader. Anybody else go get a new book and you read the ending to see if it's interesting enough to read the book? Well, when they handed me that 20 questions, it was a little yellow card, and immediately my eyes went to the end of the test. And it says, it does the quantification. It says, if You answer yes to one, you might be alcoholic. One. If you answer yes to two, you are probably alcoholic. Where are you going? You don't want to answer these questions either, do you? You answer yes to two, you are probably alcoholic. And then it says, if you answer yes to three or more, you are definitely alcoholic. I don't give a rip what's on this test. I ain't giving them three. That's just a given. The question is, do I give them one or two? I don't want them to think I'm lying. So in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking Barney's going to read me off 20 questions off this page. So we get question number one. If, when I honestly want to, do I find I cannot quit drinking entirely? And that's a fact. Every time I've wanted to quit drinking to save my marriage, to save my career in the Navy, every time I said I'm quitting, I could not quit. So I decided I don't want to. Anybody ever done that? I knew I could. I don't, and I didn't even know why I couldn't quit. I didn't have the science of ethanol alcohol there. I do now, and I'm going to share that with you, but I didn't have it at the time. So that's one yes. I got 19 to go. Or if when drinking, do I have little control over the amount I take? I'm two for two. Because I know once I take that first drink, no matter what promises I made, I can't keep them. And I don't understand that. But it's true. So that's two yeses already, and I'm basically done reading. And then it says, you are probably alcoholic. There's no more questions after that. You are probably alcoholic. I went like this. Whew, that was close. Probably. And ladies and gentlemen, I have discovered that most of us who die drunk and loaded die between probably and definitely. And I can't tell you, and if I could, I wouldn't tell you when I went from probably to definitely. It might have been the first 10 conferences my sponsor drugged me to. It might have been the first 100 meetings I was in. It might have been my first run through the steps. I don't know when I went from probably to definitely, but I'm so grateful I did go from probably to definitely alcoholic. So we're done, right? I'm alcoholic, period. No. Then there's a thing called alcoholism, which is what Clancy, I think, was talking about, the disease of perception, the ism. You see, the disease of alcoholism, and I'm gonna give you some factual science now, because you're going to probably doubt what I'm about to tell you. The disease of alcoholism is arrested upon cessation of drinking, and the obsession is lifted. That's when the disease of alcoholism is fully arrested. It ain't out there doing push-ups. It ain't wanting you dead. Isn't it nice to know something don't want you dead? We're giving that thing an artificial intelligence around here. We're being the victims of alcoholism now. When I was in my disease, which means I'm not taking responsibility, my sponsor wouldn't let me get away with that. He says, no. When you were drinking, you beat your wife. You're a wife beater. That's what you are. You're a child abuser. That's what you are. You're an animal abuser. That's what you are. It isn't you was in your disease and did all of that, because that takes away culpability. And I'm so glad, folks, because had I had that out, I would have taken it. And it wouldn't have been my fault. Therefore, nothing for me to correct. Do you hear that? Does that not make sense? And Dr. Silkworth even intimates, in his opinion, that it's arrested when we stop drinking. And how do I know that? Because in his opinion, he states that the only relief we, the men and women of science and medicine, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. That's all they got. That solves the problem. Don't drink if you're just alcoholic. But if you have alcoholism, then I'll read you the next part. It says, if that be the case, you must be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Why is that necessary to treat a disease? There is no disease known to science that is treated with a spiritual experience. Could you imagine how full this room would be if we could treat cancer, diabetes, polio, any disease known to science? AA, I'm happy to report, is not designed to treat disease of any kind. That's outside opinion. In AA, we are of the belief that I suffer from an allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. And when that allergy and obsession is relieved, I have one thing to deal with and one thing only, the spiritual malady. I don't mind taking responsibility knowing that's the problem, this internal spiritual maladjustment, the ism factor, internal spiritual maladjustment. I'm maladjusted to the spiritual life. I'm in full flight from the great reality, and therefore I become an outright mental defective. And see, for me, the ism came long before the drink. As in Bill's case. In Dr. Bob's case, the ism came after he drank, because he drank. And if you read Dr. Bob's story, when he stopped drinking, he craved alcohol for 2.5 years, but his mind and emotions returned to normal, and he never had so much as emotional fart for the rest of his life. He normalized. And they compared him against Bill, who's like a fart in the windstorm. You know he's around, and you hope he goes away quick. He's got these terrible emotions, like me. Chronic self-doubt. Anybody relate? Chronic self-doubt. Self-centered fear. And at the same time, I fancy myself sufficient. And self-reliant. And then my self-reliance fails me. And then I'm haunted by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. The proponents, the culpable proponents of this ism factor, of alcoholism. And half of us, Bill said, suffer from this before we take a drink, and the other half suffer from it after they take a drink. In 1944, Bill Wilson was invited to New York. You don't mind me going down this history road, do you? In 1944, Bill Wilson was invited to New York State to address the New York Medical Society. And they didn't invite Dr. Bob, which was curious to me. Dr. Bob, why wouldn't they invite him to the Medical Society? Why did they invite a bankrupt stock speculator? So I researched it. I was curious. They asked him a series of questions. And here's the interesting question. They asked Bill, of your fellowship of men and a handful of women, this is 1944. There weren't many of us sober yet. This group of men and a handful of women had not been drinkers. How would you describe their personality makeups? He didn't hesitate. He said, well, half would have been normal in every regard. I want to repeat, normal in every regard except for the effect alcohol has on them. They are able, intelligent, friendly people. And then he said, and the other half, and I can see him raising his own hand, would have been more or less pronounced neurotic. There is a difference between the two types, and it's important to know that because where I got sober, it was a bunch of Dr. Bob types. They were as normal as the day is long, as long as they don't drink. Some people would say, well, then they're not alcoholic, they're just problem drinkers. No, no, no. My brother's 42 years sober. Goes to one meeting a week, whether he needs it or not. Sponsors the same two guys for 41 years, and they're happy. I can't stand it. My brother calls me Smoking Volcano. Even though I'm sober 46 years, he knows I'm going to go off at any time. I asked him one time, I said, Larry, why do you go to one meeting a week? Why do you bother? And he said, your sponsor's right. You're a special kind of stupid. I said, I don't understand. I go to 7 meetings a week. I sponsor several alcoholics. I work really hard just to keep my balance for a day. And you go by like a song. I said, I don't understand. He says, I'm not like you. He says, when I got sober, my problems went away. And as long as I don't pick up that first drink, and he says, this is why I go to one meeting a week. If I don't go to one meeting a week, I may forget I can't drink alcohol safely. And so many people do that, don't they? They quit going to meetings and they forget they can't drink alcohol safely. And that's when I realized that there was hope for me. Because Bill Wilson stayed sober his whole life, remaining after he got sober, as did Dr. Bob. I don't relate to my brother at all, except for drinking. He and I both can't control our drinking, and he and I both can't quit entirely when we want to, on our own accord. That's what we have in common. That's what we all have in common. But half of us, says Bill, has this ism factor, this internal spiritual maladjustment. And I seem to have been born that way. And I share that with you because so many of us are dying. And I think in part because they really don't understand what the real problem is. They're linked, but they're not the same. It's like on November 8th, 1977, the disease was arrested in me. Are you leaving? Did I annoy you or something?
No, you didn't. I just got to go out of town tomorrow.
You didn't have to explain to me. Go to Al-Anon. Safe travels. I shouldn't do that. Billy said, I never met you before. So the ism is why I'm here. I haven't had a drink for 46 years and some odd months, one day at a time. And I have to tell you, my story exhibits the proof of that condition. And not all alcoholics have that. Bill said half. Half are like, and even Dr. Silkworth alluded to it in the big book in his opinion. He said he got through that classification of drinkers, and then he says, then there are those that are normal in every regard, except for the effect of alcoholism. They're able, intelligent, friendly people. A double board certified physician concurred with Bill in those days of that differentiation. And then that double board certified doctor says the only relief we of medicine have to offer is don't drink. And that's where you and I die. I got worse when I got sober. Anybody else? I'm the guy you want to be without drinking. It's like you've all heard about Dr. Jekyll. How many Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hydes do we have? I put my hand down because I'm not. I'm a Mr. Hyde looking for Dr. Jekyll. And I found him in a bottle of Budweiser. And I'll tell you that story shortly. So lack of power is my dilemma. I didn't know that either. Lack of power, how? Lack of power where alcohol is concerned. I have enormous amounts of willpower. And I bet so do you. Except when it comes to alcohol. My problem wasn't drugs, or it would have been that too. Because of the addictive nature of drugs. But I'm powerless over alcohol. And I didn't understand that. What do you mean I'm powerless? It's like I heard the stupidest things in my early meetings. Like I heard an old timer say, it's the first drink to get you drunk. And I thought, and I'm the one that's retarded? Nobody ever gets drunk from one drink. And I closed my mind to those people. The first drink gets you drunk. You're a special sort of stupid if you believe that. That's where I was. And if you're new, it's so true. It's the first drink to get you drunk. And I hope it confuses you like it did me. I didn't like them old people. A bunch of gray hairs is what they were. I'm powerless. Why am I powerless? I think it's important to know that. I only drank beer, by the way. Anybody else? I'm a beer drinker. Budweiser, king of beers. I love Budweiser to this day. How many of you have been to Los Angeles on the west side? Gone out to the valley? I know you have, Ricky. Have you gone out to the valley? You go over the 405 north, you get across the 101 freeway, and do you know what's at the Roscoe Boulevard exit on the west side of the freeway? Anheuser-Busch. When I drive by there, I slow down, have a moment of silence. And I also like fine wine, like Ripple. And there's enough old people in this room. You remember Ripple, don't you? If you're under the age of 45, you never drank Ripple because they closed that chemical plant down. That stuff had delusional properties to it. I also like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. I know where I am. I'll tell you why I like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Because when I puke a lot. I'm a projectile puker. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I puke a lot. And when I'm drinking Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill and I puke, it looks like I'm bleeding internally. So I lie and tell the girls in the bar I'm dying from stomach cancer. And you know how you are. They start lining up the drinks for me because they don't want me to die lonely. Oh, you girls are great. The trouble is I never die, and they keep wondering when I'm going to die. And I also like Mad Dog Deucey Deucey, Little Thunderbird, Night Train, Nis Cisco. Those were my drinks of choice. None of them have grapes. I'm a projectile puker when I drink Strawberry Hill. Anybody else? You know what I mean? It's like I had a partial denture. I have full now, but I had a partial denture back in the day. One of my big concerns is puking it and losing it. And one time I was really having a bad day. I'd been drinking Boone's Farm, Mad Dog, Cisco, and Night Train. And I was sick. And how many of you remember the ivory altar? You don't hear about that much anymore. But I was bowing before the ivory altar and everything. And I also had terminal diarrhea, so that was dangerous. Listen, when you've had diarrhea for 6 years, you got to have good decision-making skills. And you got to have split-second timing. And if you're bowing before the ivory altar and you got to puke your guts out, bad things are going to happen in that bathroom. And my denture blew out right into the stool. And I knew it was a race between me and the hole at the bottom, because welfare ain't going to give me another set of teeth. So by God, I went in after him, and I caught him right before he went down the shooter. And I thought, well, what the hell? I rinsed him off and put him right back in. I sure miss drinking. I think I need to talk about the power of alcohol. I'm powerless. So I want to talk about the power of alcohol. It's not supposed to have power, folks. I now know the science of alcohol. I know the factual science of ethanol alcohol. There are no addictive qualities to ethanol alcohol. It's not addictive by nature. That's why I was baffled, why I couldn't stop and stay stopped. 9 out of 10 people can drink alcohol safely. Creation designed us. Did you know that? Creation designed us to be able to metabolize 1 ounce of alcohol per hour. That's a fact. Depending on your weight, it may move a little bit, but not much. We're all designed to metabolize 1 ounce of alcohol per hour, unless you don't have the 2 enzymes. Just my luck. My sister has those enzymes. She's a normal drinker. I hate it. How many of you know normal drinkers? Aren't they annoying? My sister likes to bowl. I'm the younger brother, so I get to go bowling whether I want to or not. And I'm the younger brother, so I go get her shoes. You know, I'm kissing her butt, and I go get her shoes. And she wants a drink. She wants me to get her a slow gin with orange on ice. What the hell is that? Why ice? That takes up volume, you idiot. But I do it. I'm a good brother. I do it. I go get her a little drink, and now I know the insanity is about to start. Not hers, mine. Because she doesn't drink it. She just looks at it. We're bowling with people. She's paying attention to bowling. I'm paying attention to her drink because the ice is melting. Have you ever seen ice melt in a mixed drink? It's lighter than liquor. It floats to the top and drowns the perfectly good liquor. And I'm watching her ice melt, and I'm getting agitated. My sister says, what's wrong with you? I says, are you going to drink that? It's been an hour. You haven't even touched it. She says, is it bothering you? I said, yes. She says, don't look at it. Oh, problem solved. Takes her over an hour and a half to drink that drink. One drink. And then you know what she does? Will you go get me another one? No, I can't take it. So I go get her another drink. We were there 3.5 hours bowling because she has to talk to everybody in a bowling alley while she sips her drink. I am now out of my freaking mind. We're done bowling, thank God. I take her shoes back and put them up. She still got half a drink. So she's only consumed 1.5 drinks. And then she takes her keys out of her purse and hands them to me. And I said, what are you doing? She says, I want you to drive. I said, why? She says, I've been drinking. So I found it necessary to share the science of alcohol with my sister. Sharon, you got to understand something. You can metabolize 1 ounce of alcohol per hour. We've been here 3.5 hours. You drank 1.5 drinks. There's no alcohol in your blood. She says, yeah, but I'm feeling it. I said, what in Jesus' name are you feeling? You haven't had enough to feel anything. I'm feeling it. And I thought, well, let's ask her a question. I said, so what is it you're, I'm being snarky. I said, so what is it you're feeling? You know how we can put a tone to it. She says, well, I'm feeling like I'm losing control. You got to drink through that. And folks, that's when I realized the difference between them and us. When they drink a couple of drinks, they start to feel the loss of control. When I take a couple of drinks, I feel like I'm gaining control. That's the difference between me and them. And I didn't know that. It took my sister for me to understand, beyond science, what that means. And because my body cannot metabolize alcohol the way normal drinkers can, and heavy drinkers will drink past that, and they'll get drunk and in trouble, and then they'll quit and normalize. But for the alcoholic like me, I can't do that no matter how much I will it, and I want to. And I didn't understand none of this when I got sober. Creation designed me to be able to drink alcohol normally. But somehow I missed the memo. My body doesn't have those enzymes, or they're not working right. Joe and Charlie first discovered this back in their day, but they never got the names of it. And I'm going to give you the names of it just for the heck of it. Those two enzymes are called alcohol dehydrogenase and aldehyde dehydrogenase. They are used to break ethanol alcohol down into acetic aldehyde and then into acetone, and then it turns it into like a food, and it discharges it through normal body function. And if you're a normal drinker, if you have those enzymes, that doesn't mean you won't get drunk if you drink too fast, but your body will work. And you cannot get drunk if you only drink 1 ounce per hour. Now, don't you guys go out and test that theory. I think you've already proven it. But doesn't that make sense? And so when the allergy and the obsession is relieved, the disease is arrested 100%. And it's a good thing, because AA is not designed to treat disease of any kind. And medicine knows that. But what we are designed to do is to treat a spiritual malady. And that's why on page 44, I believe Bill slipped this little memo in here. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I needed to know that. I am now willing to pursue a spiritual way of life, however reluctantly. You convince me. And if you read the 12 and 12, Bill talks about how the sponsors convince the newcomers. The sponsor convinces us with their experience and their testimony and their understanding of our literature. And that happened for me. Enough of that. Let me move on. I drank a lot. I have to tell you some really ugly things, and I hope you'll withhold judgment till I'm done. I won't share anything with you I haven't recovered from. I want you to hear that. My sponsor taught me to bring my problems to him. He and I will step our way through it, and we'll bring the solution to the meeting. Because I might, if I bring it to the meeting first, I might get so many hugs and so much love, I won't feel like I need to do anything about it. He says, you bring it to me. We'll solve it. Then you take it to the newcomer and tell him how to get over it or get through it. And that is powerful medicine for Wayne Butler. And that's exactly what I did. I didn't go to a meeting and drop it on the group. I didn't cut it in half. Because you see, those hugs, you know what they do? And I'm not saying don't hug people. I'm not trying to belabor that. I'm just saying that I need all the desperation I can get. And I want to tell you why. I've discovered in my brief time of sobriety that there's three phases of 12-step development. And you know, I think most of us know about phase two, because we hear about it in the promises every time it's read. If you have been painstaking about this phase of your development, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. Phase two, the painstaking phase. I'm allergic to pain. How about you? But I understand what the three phases of 12-step development are, and I want to share those with you, and then I'm going to take you through my three phases of what I used to be like. What happened? Several things happened that were painful, and several things happened that were helpful, and what I'm like today because of that. And that first phase is desperation, steps 1, 2, and 3. Folks, I would have never taken that so important third step if I wasn't desperate for another way to go. That's the only reason I was willing to turn my life over to anything outside of myself. Because I was desperate. I've been living in a dumpster for 5 years behind Larry's Oasis. I weighed 146 pounds. Now, when you're 6'3" and you weigh 146 pounds, I want you folks to know you are too light to fight and too thin to win. My teeth were rotted. Ignore your teeth, they'll go away. I just share that with you. I was so desperate. And I just wanted one more drink. I didn't know I was wanting to drink safely. I didn't know. I didn't have those words. I kept trying to drink a different way in hopes I could find a way to drink safely. And no matter how hard I tried, I failed. And I couldn't admit that to you because I can't stand myself when I'm sober. I can't stand what I've become and who I am and what I know about myself. I can't stand myself. And I'm not drinking to escape. Just like Dr. Silkworth says, these abnormal drinkers weren't drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome an obsession beyond their mental control. And I didn't understand that either. And I want to tell you a quick story about that. I wasn't a drinker until I was 17. I was never going to drink. I watched my dad drink brown whiskey and do terrible things. And then I saw my mom drink tequila. Some of you know about that, don't you? My mom would drink tequila and wait till my dad passed out, then she'd get even. It was great. We rooted her on. Kick his ass, Mom! Then we hoped Dad wouldn't remember we yelled it. So I'm never drinking that stuff. I drink Pepsi-Cola. Now, at the age of 9, I'm going to share a couple of things that didn't make me alcoholic, but it did catapult the ism factor that supports alcoholism. At the age of 9, I'm walking home, third grade, no doors are locked, just be home before the streetlight goes out. Remember that? Don't hardly need any police in the town of Moline, Illinois. And I'm walking home and this guy comes out. I remember him looking around and he comes up to me and then he grabbed me and he pulled me into the basement of his house. All houses were coal-fired for heat. And there were no real furnaces. They were all coal-fired. And all houses where we live had coal bins in the basement. He drug me down into that coal bin, chained me in that coal bin. And for 3 days, he raped my body, he tortured my body, he put things in my body, he beat me. And then on Monday morning before dawn, he took my naked, broken body and threw me out in the middle of the street and told me if I told anybody it was him, where he was or where I was, he'd come back and kill my whole family. And I want you folks to know I never uttered a word of that until I did my first fifth step with my sponsor. That was the first person I was able to tell that to. And now I'll tell you the other part of that story. It was my uncle. I had to see him at family events. I had to see him. They couldn't understand why I didn't want to do family stuff. I'm not playing the victim card. I've recovered from this completely. I'm just sharing you facts. There's no emotion behind this right now. It's just factual information. But if you relate to it, I understand your pain. And we have relief here for that pain. It's called the 12 steps and a fellowship. We're not even a support system. We're a family. Don't you see? What Bill says in the 12 and 12 is that it didn't make me an alcoholic. It discolored my personality. And I can see how it did that. When I was 10 years old, my father, who drove truck out of Chicago, Illinois, he's a union steward to the Teamsters, worked for a guy named Jimmy Hoffa. My dad was a tough guy. He wanted me to be a tough guy. I wanted to be a Christian little boy. So he tried to help me find my way. My dad was a terrible racist. One weekend, he drove me with him down south. We went through Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. And we went to this bonfire meeting they had on this farm property. They were burning crosses, wearing goofy outfits, and they had one for me, a junior outfit. And I got groomed in the most hateful organization known to man. I'd like to tell you they didn't get me, but I'm here to report that you, I did. They did. I'm not blaming them, I'm just reporting facts. So what I was like when I came to AA, what I used to be like when I came to AA, I was a racist, a bigot, prejudiced, all these labels, homophobic, misogynistic, I was all of that and more. I was a wife beater, a child abuser mentally, emotionally, and an animal abuser. Guys like me don't get to be sober. Guys like me don't get to be a part of society. Everybody hates people like me. And I know it. And I can't stop it. The only time I'm not like that is when I drink. Isn't that's the power of alcohol. One of the reasons my dad beat me when I was an adult was because I would talk to black people in the bar. When I'm drinking, I have no racism. When I'm drinking, I get along. I want to get along with everybody. But you take the alcohol out of my body, and I go right back to that thing that they created. And I don't have the power to escape it. I want to die. Somehow I know there's something wrong with this. That's at the age of 10. And then I started acting out in school. I haven't had a drink yet. Don't you agree I need a drink? I need a drink. I didn't know that. So I'm acting out in school. They don't know anything about alcoholism in the family in 1958, 59, and 60. They just knew I was a peculiar kid. They kept trying all kinds of analyzation on me. They thought my nickname was Little Wayne, by the way. Yeah, someone hijacked it. I didn't like it either. Little Wayne. I had problems. I'm running around school biting people, eating crayons. I get up out of my perfectly good little desk chair and run headfirst into the wall just because it's there. They nicknamed me the kid that wore a helmet and didn't ride a bike. You can laugh, it's okay, I'm over it. They tried to get a bead on me in eighth grade, so they gave me the IQ test. How many of you have taken the IQ test? Come on, tell the truth. Call me out if I'm wrong. You score 100, you're pretty smart. You score a 120, you're a borderline genius. You score 150 or above, there's an organization called Mensa that will look for you, recruit you to sit in a room and think for other people and pay you. Ain't that something? Now, I got to tell you, you've all heard that rumor by people in AA that say we alcoholics are above average intelligent. I'm here to report to you in over 46 years of sobriety, Mensa has never been in any of my meetings. I can tell you that right now. And Al-Anon will support that. I scored a 57, and I didn't cheat. I got diagnosed mentally retarded, and I got put in a retarded group. That's what they called it, and I'm not going to varnish it. If you have a child with special needs, I mean no disrespect. This is what it was like for me. This is what I used to be like. Can't you see how I believed I was hopeless? I believed I was absolutely hopeless. Fast forward, I'm now in that retarded class. The bullies are out. If you're a bully, you know who you are. I was bullied. I was defenseless. I'm not anymore. I developed skills as an adult so I would never be bullied again as long as I live. I'm not a tough guy by any stretch of the imagination. Us 11 kids in that class were only allowed to do separate things, like miniature golf in the afternoon. We never read books. We just tried not to bite each other and do all that kind of crazy stuff. And we had last period gym so we didn't mix with general population. And one Friday we were walking back, three of us were dogging it, coming back, and these wrestlers grabbed us and they thought it'd be cute to lock us in a hall locker. So they locked three of us in a hall locker and I didn't know how to get out and neither did the other two. We spent the weekend in that locker. The janitor found us Monday morning by the urine on the floor. I came out different than I went in. That didn't make me alcoholic, but it put another spin on my personalities. Now, this guy named Tom found out about that, and he knew who the wrestlers were, and he beat the hell out of all three of them. He became my first sponsor. I followed that guy around like he had glue on his pants, and he took care of me. I needed protecting, and he did. As a matter of fact, I became a proficient liar. I would tell Tom they'd chase me after school again. They didn't, but he'd beat them up anyway. I made it through high school in the retarded class. Never read a book. Looked at books, never read them. We didn't take tests. Biggest test we had is finding our way to the bathroom and back. Senior prom came around. I don't know what's up. Tom says, "You're my date." I said, "Okay." He didn't mean it that other way. So I went with him. I don't know what to expect. We get to the gymnasium. He actually got me some clothes to wear. There's balloons and DJ. people dancing. I'm scared to death. I want to go back to my little room where it's safe. And Tom says, I'll be right back. And he leaves me standing there. And I'm froze in fear. He's only gone a few minutes. And then he comes back and he's got his hand tucked in his jacket. And he pulls that hand out and he's holding this long neck bottle, brown bottle with a red, white, and blue label called Budweiser. He said, here, kid, drink this. It'll make you feel better. I'd have drank battery acid for Tom. I didn't know I was a guzzler. Do you know, you hear in meetings about, they use the phrase picking up. That's the N-A and C-A phrase, isn't it? Picking up. You know what A-A's is? Bottoms up. And I heard that so many times, I knew what to do with that bottle. I took it bottoms up, and I guzzled that whole beer down, let out a big old belch, and I said, Tom, that tastes terrible. I want a Pepsi Cola. And he said, that's okay, kid, have another, you'll get used to it. Somewhere between 3 and 4 Budweisers, I got so good looking I couldn't stand it. Wasn't retarded no more, suddenly I wasn't retarded. I looked down the dance floor and saw this blue-eyed blonde dancing with some loser. I didn't know I was entering the realm of freedom from blondage. She was hot! I didn't know what to do with her, but I headed out to the dance floor, and Tom says, where are you going? I said, right there. I'm going to dance with her. He says, you've never danced. I said, I'll figure it out. I got there, and I asked her, well, he went like this. You know, I cut in. And I didn't know she recognized me from the retarded class, so she gave me a sympathy dance. Come on, girls, you know what I mean. She felt sorry for little Wayne and gave him a dance. And then we danced another dance, and her date made the mistake of going to the bathroom and leaving her with little Wayne. We stayed together the rest of the night, and I found out that night sex meant two people. I didn't know that. She ruined my sex life first time out of the gate because I've been having sex since I was 13. I thought I was good at it. And she complicated the entire procedure. When I sobered up, I couldn't believe what happened. And my life became just like that. But I was never, ever going to stop drinking. That was lightning in a bottle for me. I wasn't afraid of my dad. I didn't hate black, brown, red, and yellow people when I'm drinking. But oh, how horrible it is when I sober up. And there's no answer for that, they say. Now I have to tell you another part is before I get to the solution, there's absolutely no solution for this that I'm aware of in therapy. I've been psychiatrically institutionalized from the age of 9 to the age of 27, 17 times. I was in the Franciscan Mental Health Center 3 times. I was in the Watertown Insane Asylum for the Criminally Insane 14 times. To be fair, I self-signed in there 4 times because that's where my girlfriend lived. She was something. She was in there because she murdered her family. And she was diagnosed a sociopath. My diagnosis was psychopath. And she found me interesting. And I liked her a lot. And back in the days of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you could do about anything you wanted on that unit as long as you didn't hurt nobody. And I was just in love with this fruitcake. I was, oh my God. I didn't care if she killed her family. She's not going to kill me. I'm protected. I had serious problems, as you can tell. But you give me a few drinks and I'm okay. That's the power of alcohol. Anybody relate to that? The power of alcohol that can change our perception of reality and make us okay with ourselves for just a little while. I got 20 minutes. What happened? I'll tell you exactly what happened. AA happened. That's what happened. All the other stuff happened to me. This happened for me. I'm living in a dumpster. It's Halloween night. My dad comes visit me at my dumpster, knocks on the lid. I was home. I lifted the lid and peeked out, and there was the man I hated worse than death itself, my dad. I had no idea he'd gone to this A&A cult and got sober. But he looks in there at me and he says, Wayne, do you want to come home with me tonight? And I looked around my little room and I said, "No thanks, Dad, I'm doing fine." And he says, "Okay," and he left. Apparently you guys told him, if I resist, leave, or they'll screw up their chances of helping me. And he left. So when he left, I figured he's going to get his gun, because the last time I saw him, he threatened to kill me. So I jumped out of the dumpster and hightailed it out of there. I get down to a restaurant called Harvey's Restaurant in East Moline, Illinois. It's a mom-and-pop coffee shop for the truckers that are coming out of town. And there's always a lot of people in there, but this is Halloween night. There ain't a soul in there but this 800-year-old woman slowly wiping down the coffee bar. I sized her up and knew I could work her, because I'm a worker among street workers, if you get my drift. I walked in there and my odor hit her before I could catch up. I sit down on a wobbly stool right next to the cash register for some reason. She looks up at me and gives me a smile, drops her rag on the bar, grabs a cup of coffee and a glass of water, walks over to me, sets it down. "What can I do for you, sweetie?" And she kind of took me off my game for a minute. I was prepped to give her some information, but I caught up. And I told her this story that I didn't want to tell you. I told her what happened to me at 9. I told her the truth about that organization. I told her about being raped. Tears were rolling down her eyes, so I move in for the burger. I think I'm winning. She was in Al-Anon. By the way, if any of you are waiters or waitresses and you're in Al-Anon, wear a badge, give us a fighting chance. She fed me. She kept me there overnight. November 1st. On November 2nd, Harvey shows up. I have no idea I'm being treated already. I have no idea I've already walked into the castle of life. Harvey picks me up off the deck. And gives me the bum's handshake. How many of you had the bum's handshake? See, I'm still in phase one, desperation. I'm on step none. He picks me up and gives me the bum's handshake. Now, I know what coins feel like because I'm a bum. I know it's not money I can spend. So he finally lets go of my hand, and I look at it as a brass coin with two funky-looking A's. I thought, well, that's weird. And he says, "Turn it over." You know how glib they can be? "Turn it over." And I said, "You're short." So he turns it over. I turn it over. It's a prayer. "God grant me something." I think, what freak show is this? I'll play along. He says, "You take that coin tomorrow morning about noontime down to 410 16th Street. You're going to see some friends of mine there. You tell them Harvey sent you. Show them that coin. And I'll be along in the afternoon to give you a hand." I thought I was going to get a burger. He didn't say I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, when you get there, there'll be a light bulb in the cellar hanging on a cord. If it's on, that means they're there. Go in. Don't tell the neurotic newcomer something like that. I'm hungry. I'd like a pell-mell tailor-made and maybe some pocket. So I went. See, the only reason I went, I'm desperate. I'll do things when I'm desperate that I will not do when I'm not. And I got down there about noontime and I found the light bulb. He said if it was on, go in. It was flickering. He didn't tell me what to do if it was flickering. So I'm out there trying to figure it out. I'm doing alcoholic neurobics. I'm moving with the flickering of the light. Have you ever tried to will something to stop and it, whoa! I lost my mind. I left. Went to Larry's Oasis, bummed some Budweisers, got oiled up. Now I'm going back there because I've been thinking about them people. Now they owe me more than a burger. I've been through a lot. This Thursday night's about 8 o'clock. If it would have been any other night, they wouldn't have been there. Is it odd or is it God? Who's to say? They only had 3 meetings a week there. Thursday morning, Thursday noon, Thursday night, and Saturday noon. If this would have been any other day, they wouldn't have been there. I get back there. Now I don't care about the light. I'm going in. And I went charging down that cellarway, hit that cellarway doorway entrance. That's 5'10"-ish. I'm 6'3"-ish. I cracked the header with my eyebrow. It lifted me off of my feet. I went flat on the deck. Wind knocked out of me, slid into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a round table like that one, about 6 feet inside the door, with 6 or 7 old people sitting there talking about death and dying. And I slid between 2 of them. And this old ugly buzzard got up out of his chair and he stood over me and he goes like this. And then he said, "Slide right in here, you big dummy." We got a wrench that fits every nut that comes in the door. By the looks of you, it's going to have to be an adjustable wrench. Now, I don't like him right away talking to me. He picks me up off the deck, and he says, hi, my name's Barney. I didn't ask. And then he says, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, oh, you poor SOB. You're alcoholic. Now, I know how this works. How many of you have been in therapy? And you had that man or woman across the desk from you, and they self-disclose. Now, you know as well as you're sitting here, when they do that, they're trying to get you to self-disclose something. I know how that works. That's salesmanship 101. Lean in and booger them. So I said, well, I'm ADD. He says, I'll bet you are. I said, you know what else I am? He said, what's that? I'm OCD. He says, I'll bet you are. You know what else I think you might be? And he surprised me. I thought I won 2-1. And I said, what's that? He said, you might be ODD. Now, in 1977, in the DSM-3, there is no diagnosis of ODD. So I said, what's that? He said, you are very odd. And then he says, I'm going to be your sponsor. And for the next 5 years and 5 days, I went to meetings regularly, drank before everyone, drank after everyone, and before them Al-Anons ratted me out, I drank during meetings by hiding my quart bottle of Budweiser in the toilet tank. This Al-Anon told my sponsor, I think I know where he's getting it, because they know I'm drinking, they just can't catch me. I go to the bathroom a lot. 5 years and 5 days. It's the most miserable time of my life. Living in a dumpster. And you know what would happen? I'd leave a meeting, I'd go get a couple of drinks, and I'd get back to my dumpster, and you know what would be in my dumpster? A brand new pack of Pall Mall tailor-made Reds. Some nights there'd be a sandwich in there. Some night there'd be a $5 bill in there. It was my sponsor and his pals trying to keep me alive. Now I got to tell you another horrible story, and then I'm going to give you the solution. I could go through the steps, but we've already had that this weekend. A fine job, by the way. There's been a lot already done this weekend that I don't need to repeat. I'm just trying to give you an overview of how powerful AA is and how powerful this program is when you work it, when you accept it and practice it one day at a time. I'm still in phase one and step none. I'm so desperate, I will do anything except work. And then the exceptions begin to appear. My sponsor had to tell me, you are not an exceptional person, by the way. And I thought, what? He left that alone for a while. On February 13th, 1977, my mom let me stay at the house for a couple days. It's cold outside. She's trying to save my life. Something she said upset me, and I left there, and I set her house on fire. And I went outside and blew up my dad's car. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my 357 in my boot. And I walked into the meeting and my sponsor says to me, hey, Butler, do you know this program works better if you don't drink? I don't know why that bothered me, but I got to the other side of the room. I pulled that gun out and fired a round off at my sponsor's face. I missed him 6 inches high. I'm rated a combat expert marksman. I missed him from 30 feet away. I came to the next morning at Francis Mental Health Center, tied to a steel bed in the center of a padded room in 6-point leather restraints, black and blue from head to toe from a little AA group therapy. And I don't remember a thing about the night before. I don't know why I'm broken up like I am. I don't know why I'm black and blue, but I want to get a hold of the guys who did this to me. And I had a visitor that morning. You know who it was? It's Barney. I didn't know what I'd done, so it didn't surprise me that he came. And he walks around me there, this whole side is black and blue. And he pushes on my rib, and he says, do you feel that? I said, yes. And he said, well, there's hope. Your feelings are intact. Idiot. And he walks around, he says, you've done it this time. They're talking about keeping you and studying you a while. He says, they're talking about keeping you on a court commitment indefinitely. They diagnosed you as a psychopath with homicidal tendencies. There's not much I can do for you. But if they ever let you out of here, if you'll come with me and do what I did and still do, I believe you can recover too. It wasn't a big deal to me. I didn't know what I did. And that evening, when the on-duty nurse was going off duty outside my padded room, and she's briefing the oncoming nurse with my case, is the first time I heard what I did. And I could not believe my sponsor came and visited me if I did all that. That's when you got me. That's when AA got me. But I'm beyond hope. I'm beyond aid. The human powers of medicine, psychiatry, psychology, sociology, theology, pharmacology, and talk therapy, those human powers, Part B, have already failed to relieve me of my alcoholism. But God could and would if he were sought. I didn't know I was seeking. What happened? AA happened. They transferred me to the Watertown Insane Asylum on an indefinite lifetime commitment. They were trying to find a way to legally keep me there indefinitely. I want to give a shout out to H&I. Do you know my sponsor went to that institution every Tuesday and Friday to show movies about alcoholism, like Days of Wine and Roses, and on Friday to do a book study to people that didn't want to listen. And he knew every one of the five psychiatrists that were on that board of psychiatry that committed me. And he went to him and pled with him to let him take me home and give AA another chance. And he told him, if he acts out, I'll call you to come get him. And on October 30th, 1977, they released me into my sponsor's custody. And I went out and got drunk that night. I couldn't not drink. I sobered up 8 days later on November 8th, 1977. So what happened? What am I like now and because of what happened? Phase two. You know, the three phases are desperation, restoration, transformation. I was desperate enough to take steps 1, 2, and 3 with my sponsor. If I wasn't desperate, I would have never done it. Steps 4 through 9 are the restoration phase. And there's a duality to that Chuck C. taught me. The duality is, number one, being restored to alcohol, being restored to sanity where alcohol is concerned. I am absolutely convinced that because of my body, I am absolutely unable to ever drink alcohol again safely. I'm convinced of that beyond a shadow of a doubt. But then there's a duality to it, being restored to sanity where life is concerned. And so for me to be restored to citizenship and to be a part of life in general, I must take steps 4 through 9. And that prepares me for the transformation phase, steps 10, 11, and 12. You see, I don't have the power to change me. I hear all the time, all you got to change is everything. And I think most newcomers think, what are you talking about, change everything? Because I humanly can't. So I don't tell people that. I can't change everything. The change agent is the 12 steps. That's what changes me. I didn't know that. The 12 steps are God's agents of change. And his kids who are sober and have taken the steps and they're trying one little bit more to succeed, they're his agents, as am I. In step 3, he is the father, we are his children. He is the director, we are his agents. I wasn't fit to be an agent. I wasn't recovered. And so because I was so desperate to change and not to go back to the Watertown Insane Asylum and to be a free man, I was willing to do anything. I was willing to go through the steps 4 through 9. And how do you make amends for what I became? I'm going to tell you about sponsorship. When I was 3 months sober, how much time do I got left? 8 minutes? What, 8? Okay. Well, I want to be honorable to his CD. What was I saying? That's my train of thought. When I was 3 months sober, a fellow by the name of Charles, who happened to be black, asked me to sponsor him. And I pulled that gun out and put it in his face. I called him a name and said, get away from me, I'll blow you away. I got home that night and got a call from my sponsor. Heard you told Charles you wouldn't sponsor him. I said, in so many words. I said, you know I can't sponsor him. You heard my fifth step. You know why. He said, let me explain something to you, dummy. Are you aware nobody in AA likes you? Not one person. I said, I'm aware. So much for love and tolerance. He says, are you aware they're having a group conscience meeting Sunday to throw you out? I said, I'm aware. He said, are you aware? Are you convinced that you can't stay sober without a sponsor? I said, yes, I'm convinced I can't stay sober without you. And he said, here's the deal. You're going to call Charles up. You're going to apologize. You're going to tell him you were wrong. You're going to beg him to forgive you. You're going to tell him you'll never use that word again as long as you live. And then you're going to beg him to let you sponsor him. And I'm okay with that because I know there's not a snowball's chance in Hades that he's going to want me to sponsor him after what I did. So I called Charles up confident. I didn't believe a word I said to Charles, not one word, but I said it anyway. And Charles starts crying. He says, I can't believe this just happened. And then he says, I'd be happy to have you as my sponsor. And I thought, well, that didn't work. 3 months later, this 6-foot-tall lesbian comes up to me, pokes me in the chest, says, you're going to sponsor me. I said, get away from me. Get on your kickstand and get your ass out of here. That's what I said to her word for word. Got a call that night from my sponsor. Heard you told her you wouldn't sponsor her. Same routine. I called her up and she laughs. She says, I told you was going to sponsor me. And then Adam, the Jewish fellow, comes up to me. That's just not good. I'm not about to tell you what I did. Got a call that night. Heard you wouldn't sponsor Adam. I thought, this ain't going well. Called up Adam. I still sponsor him to this day. I found out later my sponsor was sending them to me. That happened 6 more times in my first 2 years. You see, my sponsor heard my 5th step. He knew the only way to solve a spiritual sickness like mine is to work with the very thing I was taught to hate. And not an ounce of that is in my body anymore. That's not supposed to happen. That's what I'm like today. I don't know that I love everybody because I know what love means. I was taught here by you what love means. It means to serve you. It means to look out for your best interest. Somehow I'm not in the picture. I don't understand that sometimes, but the truth of the matter is, if I say I love you, I'm saying I'll look out after you, I'll protect you, I'll care for you, I'll do for you. And that's why I avoided that word for a long, long time, because I didn't want to care about anybody. And what's happened is these 12 steps, the transformation phase, steps 10, 11, and 12, that I try to apply on a daily basis for that emotional sobriety thing we talk about, I've been given the gift of desperation. And that gift saw me through the first 9 steps so that I could get myself into that transformation phase. And by the way, I'm not transformed yet. I've been transformed, but the job ain't done yet. I still have those moments. I'm a butthead. I'm still defiant at times. I'm still rebellious, but it doesn't last very long. When I go to bed at night, I do my review just like I did last night. I put in my review, can't get that stupid Nicky Ricky thing out of my head. God help me. And he helped me at 6:05 a.m. And then I try to be a better man each and every day. I have not laid my hands on a woman inappropriately from that time to this. All through sponsorship. Everything that I used to hate has asked me to sponsor him. Charles married my son's mother. I officiated the wedding. That's impossible. I don't say I have black friends, red friends, brown friends, yellow friends. I have friends. AA is colorblind. Thank you, AA. Aren't we fortunate? Yes, sir. I didn't think I'd ever get over that. I didn't think I would ever get away from that. Give me a 2-minute warning there, buddy. I share that because it's distasteful, it's ugly, but it tells you the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, how that power is even greater than the power of alcohol. And I need a power greater than alcohol. And God knows I can't stay sober on him alone. He knows that. So he gave me AA to keep me sober. See, if God could keep me sober, I wouldn't need you. I can't tell you how many times I prayed and got drunk anyway. How many times I prayed on the battlefield and watched my fellows in Vietnam fall and I didn't. And I don't believe God took them and left me. I think life took them. I came, well, we used to call him different names. I'll just say Charlie. I come up on this one guy, and you know what he was doing? He was praying. It was him or me. He's praying. And he's probably praying to the same God I'm praying to. He doesn't want to die. I don't want to die. But it's circumstances. It's life. Where God comes into play is helps me walk through it and get out on the other side. And here I've come to love this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart and soul. I hope you do too. And if this can work, I'm not going to be arrogant and tell you if this will work for me, it'll work for anybody. I'm not arrogant like I once was. I'm going to tell you that given my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and those three phases of 12-step development, and giving myself up completely, not only to God, but to AA. God and AA are like fish and water. Fish don't know that water is their higher power. They don't know that. But catch a fish and drop it on the bank and see what it does. Any fishermen in the room? Have you ever seen one flop inland? Have you? They don't flop inward. They want back in that water. They're desperate to get to that water. That's how I am about AA. I am now desperate to get to AA. Wherever I am, with whomever I'm with, I'm desperate to be in AA. And so, as I live in those three phases of 12-step development, I help walk my sponsees through those three phases of 12-step development. And I tell them what they are. I want them to know where they are. They're at step none, phase one, desperation. I'm not going to give you a bunch of hugs and a bunch of BS to make you feel better. The steps will make you feel better. And one last thought. I am so grateful how Bill wrote in step four, this is a fact-finding, fact-facing proposition. It is not a feeling-finding, feeling-facing proposition. Because what I've learned, when I've been willing to face the facts of my existence and accept them, my emotions normalize. And that's my experience. I didn't know that was possible. When I'm willing to accept the facts of my life that are in front of me, accept them, and move towards their correction, my feelings normalize all by themselves. And that's my experience. Fact-finding, fact. How many of you remember Dragnet? Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. I train all my sponsees. Facts. Be fact-based. Don't be feeling-based. Be fact-based. Your feelings are always going to be there. Don't toy with them. Be fact-based. And as I face the facts of my... Do I have time to do one more thing? How many of you know Dr. Paul? Acceptance is the answer to all my problems. What he said to me was, I have to accept that I have a problem before I'm willing to work towards its solution. So in that sense, acceptance is the answer to all my problems. And I've had to accept many, many things in my life if I want to be happy, joyous, and free. And I have achieved the two goals of AA for one day. And if you're wondering, when they say, if you want what we have, are you willing to go any lengths to get it? The it is two things. Victory over alcohol and freedom from the bondage of self. Thank you.